The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Today, it is Wednesday, August 22nd. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to help end the senseless prohibition of marijuana in America. Just visit norml.org to get involved with reform today. There are lots of ways to join and support Normal. You can get a Rick Steves Hemp Travel Pack for joining Normal at the $100 level. Check that out on Normal's website at normal.org. We also have links to join right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Folks, prohibition is 70 years old. It's not going to stop unless every single one of us gets involved. So make sure you get involved today. Got a great show for you here today. We're going to speak with Dr. Mitch Earlywine in our weekly cannabis science segment. Mitch also has a new column in High Times magazine, Ask Dr. Mitch. Make sure to check that out as well. Also in the program today, we're going to continue our interview with sociologist Harry G. Levine. His investigation into the arrest statistics for marijuana violations in New York City uncovered some surprising data. We have already heard earlier this year that so many of those arrests are based on a racial disparity. 85% of marijuana violation arrests in New York City are black or Hispanic individuals. But Harry's data also uncovered that 91% of those arrests are men instead of women. So very, very interesting stuff. Today, we'll talk to Harry about the root causes of why so many people do get arrested for marijuana violations in New York City and the police culture surrounding that. We interviewed Harry in yesterday's Audio Stash as well. If you missed that show, you can link up to it right up on our homepage at normalaudiostash.com. If you're listening on one of these Stash Flash players out there on the internet, just click the Other Stashes button and link back to yesterday's show. In the Audio Stash tomorrow, we're going to hear from Mason Tvert of Safer Choice in Colorado. Their initiative in Denver to make marijuana the lowest law enforcement priority in that city is now officially on the ballot after a wonderful petition gathering campaign. We'll speak with Mason about that during our Audio Stash news section tomorrow. Also in the Audio Stash tomorrow, we have a very special and exclusive interview with someone who operated a medical marijuana dispensary in California, actually in the town of Oakdale, California. We've all heard about all the raids that happened in Los Angeles, but there were actually no arrests in any of those raids, and they were carried out by the Los Angeles Police Department. Tomorrow we're going to hear from Addison, whose collective was raided by the local police, the local Stanislaus County Drug Enforcement Agency, as they call themselves. Something very interesting happened during that raid. Not only was Addison arrested at his home, but the police officers opened the dispensary themselves and posed as employees, and then arrested two of the caregivers who were delivering medicine to the dispensary that day. We'll speak with Addison about his experience in Oakdale, California just a few weeks ago. In tomorrow's Audio Stash, make sure to tune in tomorrow. But today we have our Cannabis Science segment with Mitch Earlywine and the conclusion of our interview with sociologist Harry G. Levine. Professor Levine will join us again in September. Let's get right to our Cannabis Science segment now. Us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash for our Cannabis Science segment is Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at the State University of New York, author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. We have links to the books on our website at normalaudiostash.com. You can also catch a new monthly column by Mitch in High Times magazine. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to speak with you again this week, Mitch. Now, I'd like to cover two different areas with you today. First is the concept of a 60-day medical cannabis supply for patients. And then I'd like to look into the Associated Press painkiller investigation a bit as well with you. But let's begin with the 60-day supply. Yesterday, we spoke with Jennifer Shaw at the ACLU of Washington about that amount definition there. But let me ask you, why is 60 days of cannabis and that amount of supply so important to medical users?
I know that we're accustomed to the idea of a 30-day supply based on other pharmaceuticals, but I feel like, particularly with cannabis, we're often dealing with folks who are the sickest of the sick, who really don't need to have any extra visits to the pharmacy. It can often be a real hassle, particularly if, you know, you're already experiencing some of the symptoms that cannabis is most known for helping to treat. So anything we can do to make their lives a little bit easier, I think, is a huge advantage. I realize the other side is often, oh, but then they'll have so much lying around, they'll end up using more than they really need or something like that. We've got new data suggests that at least for the insomnia treatment and some of the appetite-related treatment, there really isn't extreme tolerance to cannabis for these symptoms, and that the opportunity to really, you know, be humane here, give these people a little more ease in their lives is something that I don't want to miss out on for a risk that seems to me relatively minor.
And Mitch, what might constitute a 60-day supply for patients?
As we first started talking about this, I went ahead and fired up some old data of mine looking at medical users, and generally we've got average medical users need cannabis almost every day if they're, you know, treating some of the ailments that cannabis is most useful for. And so I feel like we want to err on the side of giving them as much as possible. I talk to physicians about, you know, why do we have recommendations for, you know, amounts for any drug, really? And their concern is usually about efficacy and safety. And you want to have, you know, enough medication for the person to be able to alleviate symptoms, and yet not a dose that's going to have negative consequences in any way. Well, when we start thinking about cannabis, the risk for toxicity is you know, zero, so we don't really have that issue. Some folks are concerned about, you know, what if you ended up using more than you meant to and ended up experiencing intoxication? Well, that's something also we can learn to moderate in just a couple of attempts. And then the concern about efficacy is, as I look at these data that I've gathered from medical users, the range that people need is really dramatic. There are some folks who really need, you know, less than a gram a day, other folks who really only get symptom relief at a gram a day or more. And I'd like to be able to say, well, they ought to be able to have that simply because that's what they need. And I feel like it's something that they can work out on their own or, you know, in collaboration with their health professionals. And then to give them a 60-day supply shouldn't be such a big deal.
And for patients looking to acquire a 60-day supply of medical cannabis, transporting 60 days worth of medicine, especially in states that are still in legal limbo for this, could really catch them into some legal trouble, even in states that do have legal medical access.
The underground market is a dangerous place. Unfortunately, a 60-day supply may exceed the, you know, 25 gram or 1 ounce limit that a lot of states have under their decriminalization statutes. So if you have over 1 ounce, suddenly the penalties increase really dramatically, really quickly in a whole number of states. And states that don't actually have decriminalization, we could, you know, see some really serious jail time for possession of what is, in many medical users' lives, a rather minor two-week supply. But I'd love to see people be able to have access to 60 days in a medical setting. And, you know, in truth, it's no surprise for me to say I really don't understand why this isn't available under markedly more simple circumstances.
And, Mitch, many of the patients I've spoken to, especially MS patients, prefer edible preparations for their medical cannabis. You know, does that take more whole plant material to make those edible preps?
Almost invariably, and it's interesting because people say, oh, well, you're going to use the cannabis and none of it is lost to side stream smoke or anything like that. The problem is in the preparation of the butter or oil that's usually required to make the edibles, there you have a less efficient transfer, and then that's why you do end up needing more.
And what might constitute a 60-day supply for patients who do use edible preparations?
In truth, somebody you know, who's accustomed to that dosage might require as much as 120 grams as a 60-day supply. So, you know, you could see how that's, you know, markedly more than the 25, 26 grams we see under decriminalization laws, and they could be in a world of trouble if they weren't permitted to have that amount.
Righto. Well, we'll hear more about that 60-day supply in Washington State as they move forward with it there. Mitch, also today I'd like to discuss this Associated Press investigation into the use of prescription painkillers. We ran a news item on this yesterday, and one of the drugs that has seen the most explosive growth in use and has turned a huge profit for the drug maker Purdue Pharma LP is OxyContin. This is a drug that's widely prescribed. It's also very widely abused out there. Mitch, how addictive is the drug OxyContin?
Bob Gore and I have a chapter in my book, Pot Politics, comparing the addictiveness ratings of mental health professionals. They all took a whole list of drugs and said, how addictive do you think this is? And OxyContin is always the top or right next to heroin, whereas cannabis is, you know, always near the bottom, right around caffeine. So I think that, you know, we're talking about literally markedly more addictive than folks who are accustomed to marijuana. And all the opiate drugs have had this quality since, you know, 6400 BC when we got pipes for people smoking opium back in the day. This is clearly a drug that you develop tolerance to relatively rapidly, that people experience a very genuine and often very severe withdrawal, and that's how people end up strung out on it. It's really almost the platonic form, the definition of what an addictive drug really is.
Now, these drugs are prescribed frequently for a variety of reasons. I was prescribed Percocet years ago when I had my wisdom teeth removed, and it contains the same active drug as OxyContin. So, you know, how quickly can someone with a prescription become addicted to these drugs?
It's interesting because there are really vast individual differences on this. And folks who, you know, take these opiate drugs and report being sedated and a little bit nauseated, of course, are at less risk for developing problems with them than folks who take them and say they're mildly stimulated and they don't experience any nausea at all. So the range is really, really dramatic. But often, at least our laboratory experiments suggest, in as little as 5 days of regular administration, you're going to experience some tolerance and some withdrawal, although not, you know, not as severe as sort of our stereotype of heroin withdrawal or something like that. And the range is really big, so some people aren't going to have it, and some people really would be susceptible.
Now, these drugs, like OxyContin, are perhaps most often prescribed to the older generation today. Is there any particularly increased risk of addiction for seniors who take these drugs?
It's very much the case that they're more likely to become addicted in part because the dosage is really just distributed in your lean body mass. And often, you know, older adults are smaller, or if they are heavier, it's not muscle mass that they have that the drug is going to get dissolved in, but fat tissue that doesn't absorb any of the drug. So the dose for, you know, two guys who both weigh 180, but one guy is all muscle and the other guy's all fat, the guy who's all fat ends up actually with a higher dose given just how much muscle mass he has.
And Mitch, how easy is it for an accidental overdose to happen with a drug like OxyContin?
The scary part about overdosing with the opiates is it's really, really possible, and you literally shut down the part of your brain that tells you to breathe. So this is not a toy in any sense of the word, markedly more toxic than cannabis or a lot of other drugs that we're accustomed to. And unfortunately, the methods of administration can really be critical for this as well. So people need to understand that this isn't something you mix with alcohol. You have to be very careful with antihistamines on these kinds of medications. And then, of course, only take them when you're really in pain. Don't take them reflexively, and then that risk decreases. But otherwise, I'm afraid the risk for overdose is very real, very possible, and unfortunately only has to happen once.
And Mitch, if cannabis were more widely available for pain, would this be a safer way to offer pain management to the millions of Americans apparently already using drugs like OxyContin? Could they switch to cannabis?
In fact, I think that's very much the case. Not only cannabis, but also relaxation techniques, stress reduction, all these other things that contribute to pain. They're good ways of decreasing pain without the opiates. And folks who end up just using cannabis as a supplement often find they can decrease their opiate drug use. And that's a wonderful way to keep the tolerance from developing. So if you're taking less of the opiate drugs or taking them less frequently, the opportunity for tolerance decreases, and cannabis can be a wonderful adjunct to that. We've also seen, as far as, you know, some drugs like codeine and things like that, particularly with tooth extraction, like what you were just discussing there, cannabis-based meds can be just as effective and end up doing a really superb job. Some folks are concerned about, you know, the cognitive effects, basically. Well, are you going to be impaired? And in fact, many folks can report, you know, pain relief before there are really any psychoactive or subjective effects of cannabis, and that's exactly what we're looking for, and I think that's the opportunity to really sidestep some of these problems with the opiate drugs in an effort to make sure, you know, we can get the best use out of them, the most appropriate use, without having to risk people getting dependent.
And why isn't there a wider call from the pharmaceutical industry and doctors themselves to explore cannabis for pain? Because it is non-toxic and essentially non-addictive compared to things like Vicodin or OxyContin.
I can only offer conjecture about that, but the bottom line may be, where is the potential for profit? If you're going to use a pain reliever that you can grow in your own backyard, obviously a lot of pharmaceutical companies are not going to benefit. So why should they go to great lengths to make sure you can do that when, in fact, they can earn more money by advertising and playing up these other pain medications?
You know, though, I live here in New Jersey. I grow tomatoes in my backyard, but I still buy tomatoes at the store. And certainly someone who's in pain or who's gotten, you know, to the point of unbearable pain today, they wouldn't want to go out and plant a seed and wait for the medicine to grow. They'd have to go buy it somewhere.
That's a wonderful point, Chris. And I guess the other explanation may be that we're just not accustomed to this. We've had a number of pain meds, particularly opiates, for thousands of years, and almost always somehow accessible through legal means. Because of the last 70 years with cannabis being, you know, completely prohibited in one way or another, we find out that people just don't have the experience, don't know what attitudes to apply, and have confusion about whether or not it can be an appropriate medication, in part because of propaganda or improper training or just ignorance.
Now, Mitch, some of the reports I have seen written about this Associated Press study say that the rate of painkiller use now is, quote-unquote, alarming. But is that true? I mean, are there any flags going up for you just based on the fact that so many of these drugs are prescribed out there?
In truth, I'm not all that alarmed despite the big numbers, in part because it's not how many people are using, it's how many people are experiencing negative consequences. And unfortunately, as more people use than people are concerned, well, then more people are going to end up with negative consequences. We'll have to wait and see. But it's completely possible to use opiate meds for pain without experiencing any negative consequences, with very little development of tolerance, very little withdrawal, and no impairment in your functioning in any sort of way. So I don't think we need to jump up and down and go crazy because suddenly these medications are more available. But I would like to make sure everybody who's a consumer of pain meds understands that there are a whole lot of alternatives, things as simple as relaxation, medical cannabis, of course, and, you know, other pain relievers that are available over the counter, as well as these opiate drugs, rather than just reflexively saying, oh, I'm supposed to take three of these a day, so I will.
Well, Mitch, this has been a wonderful conversation, as it is every week. I really appreciate you letting us sort of explore all of the topics we do with you and exploring these topics with us today. Thanks again for joining us here.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York. He is author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books on our website at normalaudiostash.com. You can also catch a new monthly column by Mitch in High Times magazine. Mitch joins us each Wednesday here for our Cannabis Science segment.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
You're listening to NORML's Daily Audio Stash.
Next up today, we're going to continue our conversation with sociologist Harry G. Levine of Queens College at the City University of New York. New York City arrests more citizens for marijuana violations than any other city in the United States. More than some whole states, in fact, and perhaps more than any other city on the planet. Professor Levine dug up all of the data associated with these arrests and then interviewed many members of law enforcement to find out why these arrests went up so dramatically. He published it all in his recent article, The Marijuana Arrest Epidemic in New York City, 1997 to 2006. We have links to the full article online at normalaudiostash.com. We spoke with Professor Levine yesterday. If you missed that show, you can link to the MP3 right up on our homepage at normalaudiostash.com or just click Other Stashes in the Stash Flash Players. Professor, in talking about the racial disparity of marijuana arrests in New York City and the fact that 85% of them are individuals who are black or Hispanic and 91% are male, isn't there a fear among the police administrators and the city government there in New York City that these numbers will make the department appear racist, even if they know they're not, even if the individual officers are not racist themselves? I mean, why practice this policy in this way?
Well, okay, it really comes to some of the internal police department reasons for why they're making the arrest in New York, which is really the hidden iceberg part of this story. I think their fear of appearing racist and arbitrary and repressive and wasteful is why the police don't talk about the marijuana arrests, why they don't stand in front of charts showing, you know, huge rising lines showing how many arrests they've made. Between 1997 and 2006, in the last 10 years, New York City has arrested 360,000 people for possessing small amounts of marijuana. Almost everybody arrested was put in handcuffs, taken to the station, fingerprinted, mugshot, had their info sent to the FBI, and then they were brought to one of the city's five jails and held overnight. The previous 10 years was almost one tenth the level of arrests, and the previous 10 years before that was about a ninth the level of arrests. So we have literally 10 times growth in marijuana arrests in the last decade over the previous decade. The police department doesn't talk about that. They don't want to discuss that, and if they possibly can, they will fudge it by saying, oh, well, the arrests are down in the last blah, blah, or something, you know. And sometimes they'll just flat out misinform or lie about what's going on. We are familiar with that with the Bush administration of, you know, people who get up and say things that turn out not to be true. Well, I mean, it's not uncommon in other agencies in the New York City and the police department, particularly under Giuliani and now under Bloomberg, is a lot like the Defense Department and under Donald Rumsfeld or the White House under George Bush, in that they will say what is politically convenient for them, not necessarily what is true. The other thing to understand about the marijuana arrests in New York, and I think it's a really important part of this story, is that that there is political support, there is kind of there economic support and organizational support within the police departments for the arrests, independent of anything outside of it. Ordinary beat cops, it turns out, again, it starts with Giuliani, but it becomes, in a way, institutionalized. Ordinary beat cops, street cops, like the marijuana arrests. Why? Because they're safe. Because they're relatively easy. They're not going to get shot. They're not going to get stabbed. Marijuana arrestees tend to be relatively agreeable people. They're actually quite desirable as people who you have to arrest. When a cop makes an arrest, he is, in the words of the police, married to somebody, sometimes for many hours. Marijuana arrestees are, as one cop put it to me, clean, meaning physically clean. They're not smelly. They're not dirty. Drunks may throw up on you. Likewise, a heroin junkie. They may have AIDS. Marijuana users, people with marijuana in their pocket, don't have dirty syringes. They're not likely to have AIDS. So if you've got to make arrest, and that's the job, and if you've got to spend several more hours in somebody's company, marijuana arrestees are quite desirable. They're safe. It's relatively safe and pleasant work. Secondly, beat cops, and this is a really important part of the story, get overtime when they make an arrest toward the end of their shift. They process the people that they arrest. They bring them through the whole process, fingerprinting, mug shots, and so on, and sometimes we'll carry them down to the central jail, and that's 3 or 4 more hours of overtime at time and a half pay. Pay levels in the New York Police Department are historically low levels, counted for cost of inflation, cost of living, inflation, and so on. So the cops really, really want overtime, and although it's not a formal policy, every street officer in New York knows that they can get at least 35 hours of time and a half overtime a month, but you can only get it in certain ways, and mainly the way you get it is you make an arrest toward the end of your shift. So you're looking for somebody that you can bring in with anything, and marijuana, if you stop people and stop and frisk them, and New York City had over 500,000 stop and frisks, that's a whole other story, in 2006. And some part of those frisks, they actually go into people's pockets, legally, illegally. They ask permission, they say you don't mind, or they just do it a lot of the times, and they find, and they're looking for anything they can find, weapons, stolen credit cards, but the most likely thing that somebody, particularly young people, are likely to have in their pocket that can get them arrested is a nickel bag, a small amount, a joint, a piece of a blunt, of marijuana, and that becomes a completely arrestable offense. The cop gets to put him in handcuffs and bring him in, and he gets overtime. This is so important to the police that they have their own term for describing these, making these marijuana and other misdemeanor arrests toward the end of a shift, and they call them collars for dollars. Now, police supervisors also like the arrests. Why would police supervisors like the arrests? Well, supervisors like the arrests because the number one problem facing police supervisors at every level in the system, whether it's the death sergeant, or it's a squad commander, or a precinct commander, all the way up to the chief of police, is where the hell are my cops right now and what are they doing? And when cops are out making lots of marijuana arrests, they're keeping busy. They're records. They're writing down where they are and what they've done, and they are, so, and the records are useful for everybody in the system to show, you know, where you are, what you're doing. They're not off, you know, loafing, eating donuts, going to a porno house, harassing prostitutes or whatever. They're keeping busy in some kind of way, which is regarded as good for the department. When ordinary street cops get overtime pay, their supervisors also get overtime pay for a certain percentage of the people, when the people working under them pick it up. So the overtime becomes important not just for the street cops but for the supervisors as well. For them too, it's collars for dollars.
Wow.
The top brass of the police department also like the marijuana arrests, because when you have people out making marijuana arrests, and there are squads, there are particularly parts of the narcotics police that go out, 4 guys in a van, generally an unmarked van, prowling, looking for people, or going to certain places and setting up what I call salmon nets, where they just scoop up everybody going by and search them. The if something big should come up in the city, you have a bombing, you have a fire, there's some kind of catastrophe, gas explosion, there's something at the UN, the president's in town, and you have to pull police over to cover this crisis, you can pull them off of marijuana arrest squads, and nothing bad is affected. No ongoing crime, no ongoing investigations, nothing dangerous happens as a result of pulling people off and making marijuana arrests. And since nobody knows about these things anyway, it doesn't really matter. And then when the crisis is over, they can put the police back. They can even double them up for a while if they feel like they want to keep their numbers up or the cops want some overtime or something. And so the marijuana squads and marijuana having officers make, even patrol officers making ordinary patrol officers making lots of marijuana arrests means that you have a kind of reserve army within the police department that the police can then send around to do other things when they need to do it. And finally, another very important part of why this sort of support within the police department for these arrests is a kind of push that really starts with the federal government under, you know, and it was probably true to some extent under Janet Reno, and it gets more intense under Ashcroft and the Bush, and now Alberto Gonzalez, it pushes down from the federal government to state governments to county governments and municipal governments to get as many people as possible, quote, into the system, meaning fingerprinted, mugshot, to be able to build up our database of just known subjects. I mean, lots of police and police-oriented criminology people would love to have, you know, everybody in the United States and have their fingerprints, mugshots, and DNA, if at all possible. You know, a kind of super file of these things. There's nothing that the police can do that gets as many new people into the system as making low-level marijuana arrests. It is the thing that it's your biggest scoop that they have in some ways. So the police supervisors, along with the patrol police and the narcotics police, like the marijuana arrests, for a variety of their own internal police department reasons. And this has given the arrests enormous support and lots of reasons for the police to pretend they're not going on, to send up smoke about, oh, it's not happening here, or this is used to be, or and let me show you what's going on in this other thing here. And to a remarkable extent, political forces in New York City are wary of tangling with the police, and the media is really wary of tangling with the police. The you would think the New York Times, the Daily News, the major newspapers in New York, what, you know? Well, it turns out, of course, that the bread and butter for all media, television news we know about, local television news we know about, but it's true for all the newspapers, front page of the Daily News or front page of the New York Post, for God's sake, is about crime stories. It's about, you know, somebody, you know, shot, axed, stabbed, whatever. If it bleeds, it leads is the right journalism motto on these things. And you get those from the police department. And the police department give you the details of what's happened in this case and that case. And as Stephen Colbert said at the White House press dinner, the job of the reporters in this case is to write down what it is that the government, in this case the police, say. And that's what they do. Sometimes they just take police handouts and change the words slightly and print them up, and they get the story from the police. If a reporter, or for that matter, a newspaper, should begin to investigate the police doing about something about the police that the police don't like, this source of information dries up. Their capacity to get a story. For many crime beat reporters tend to be young reporters. They tend to be new reporters. They tend to be, this is their job. Their job is to go to the police department, to one police plaza, the central police facility in New York where there's a press facility, and get the stories that the police are releasing about what the crimes of the day or so on are, or the updates on the newest one. And if you don't do that, or if you go do something else that pisses off the police department so they say, you get out of here, you go over there, or I'm not giving you this story, then you can't do your job. So the job of the reporter is to be nice to the police department, is to not piss them off, is not to ruffle their feathers. And that's true for young reporters. It's true for older reporters. It's true for the whole police beat and journalism operation. It's true for the city desk, which is the part of newspapers that handle this. It's certainly true for the TV news. So there's no journalism, you know, in the mainstream press that has any interest whatsoever in covering this stuff or in upsetting the police, and lots of interest in focusing attention elsewhere.
That was sociologist Professor Harry G. Levine of Queens College at the City University of New York. You can read the entire article he published about his data and interviews with law enforcement. It's called The Marijuana Arrest Epidemic in New York City, 1997 to 2006. We have links to that article right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.